everybody. It is with great pleasure that I introduce the speaker to you this evening. She's a student of anthropology and sociology and has had a tremendous amount of experience in gathering facts, being the author of the book, The Documentary Report, The Source of Speech, which is a report of his radio communications with our friends from other planets. She is working at the moment on another book, Other Tongues and Other Flesh, and I feel sure you will find that just as interesting. She has been friendly with and has had a great many conversations with other men who have had experiences with the so-called source of people. And if you have any questions, we will have a period at the end when they can be answered. We have had some of them that have been handed in, and Mr. Williams will answer them in time. I think that in spite of the heat, you will feel that this evening has not been wasted. You will find it very enjoyable and very enlightening. It is a great honor to have the privilege of introducing Mr. George Williams, Rick Williams.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here in Detroit, especially since I have been brought here under the auspices of the Sponsors of Truth, headed by my good friend, Neva Del Hunter. Neva Del, would you stand up wherever you are, please? Right there. He didn't know I was going to do that. It's a great privilege to be here to speak to you on the subject of flying saucers. The term flying saucer, until very recently in the world, has proven to be more laugh-provoking than it has been thought-provoking. But people all over the world are beginning to realize that this phenomenon, known strategically as the flying saucer, may have a great bearing on the life of each and every one of us in the not-too-distant future. As Mrs. Potter said, I know many men who have had similar experiences. I happened to be with Mr. George Adamski in November of 1952, and he had his memorable contact in the desert, near Desert Center, California, on November 20th of 1952, and he had his memorable experience with a flying saucer and the Venusian. My wife and I were both witnesses to that event. But our work in flying saucers started long before the contact with Mr. Adamski. In fact, before we knew Mr. Adamski. It was through our own work that we heard of him and eventually met him. In August of 1952, we had our own contact via shortwave or radio telegraphy. I had been up a year or more previously in Minnesota, where I was working amongst the Chippewa Indians, gathering little-known legends and facts about this particular group of Chippewas that had never been accumulated or written down before. I lived in some of the backcountry near Vibert, Minnesota, and I also did work at Milan, Milan's Lake, which some of you are familiar with, and the Chippewa was there. I didn't know anyone about saucers, and most everyone else did. There had been a few things in the newspapers, and I had, of course, heard of flying saucers, but that's all that I knew. And on my way up to Minnesota, I went up on the bus. I picked up Major Donald Keyhoe's first book on the saucers, The Flying Saucers Are Real, in a pocketbook edition. And I never read the book, never even started it. I got up to Minnesota, and for 1 week, it was raining. Those of you who've been in Minnesota know that in the fall, you get a lot of rain once in a while. And it rained steadily for about a week. I couldn't get out of my cabin to do any field work, so I picked up the book. And I didn't put it down, believe me, until I finished it. And after I had read it, I was surely convinced myself that at least that these things could be interplanetary. Because here was a man, a former Marine major, who had gone into the thing in an objective way and had analyzed all the facts and came to the conclusion that there couldn't be anything but something from outer space. In fact, I think he mentioned in the book that it was pretty hard for him to swallow and it was a little fantastic, but if that's all it could be, why, that's what it had to be. Immediately, all of the ledgers that I had been collecting began to fall in place. And I thought, good heavens, a lot of these things I've been collecting sound like flying saucers. I hadn't thought of it before. But that book seemed to make everything fall in place. And I wrote to my wife, who couldn't come up to that country with me because she suffered from arthritis. And I wrote to her. She was doing work amongst the Opica Indians in Mexico. And I said, listen, I think I went on to something. I wish you'd check into it for me. Well, she wrote back and said, well, I've been running onto the same thing now that you mentioned. On further investigation, we found that all American Indian tribes practically have the same stories. Now, they will, there'll be slight variations naturally, but they almost all have the same stories, the same basic facts. For a long time, anthropology discarded Indian legends and legends of so-called primitive peoples throughout the world because they said they were merely destroying superstitious people and had no basis in fact. But no longer are they doing that. They realize now that there has to be something to start a story. And although these people did not write down their stories because they did not have a written language, and these things were passed from generation to generation, nevertheless, there had to be something that caused these stories in the beginning. Now, to crystallize, I'll give you one or two of the legends, just very briefly, because we could go on, believe me, for nights and many nights in discussing the various legends. But they're all about the same. Amongst the Chippewas, they have legends of what they call the Jim Glim, or the earth rumblers, or the wheels that rumble the earth. And the story, in essence, is this, that at various times, this rotating wheel, or whirling wheel, sometimes surrounded by a cloud, would be seen, and lightning sometimes would be seen to shoot out of it. Out of it would step a young man, always a young man, and a fair-haired young man. The Navajos call him Baca City, the fair-haired god or the fair-haired boy who comes from the sky. Our blue trees are known to the Navajos and the Paiutes as the little people who come in flying boats. Now those stories are found throughout the United States, and later my wife and I both discovered that almost all so-called primitive peoples throughout the world have the same story. When I came back to Arizona, I met my wife, and we took up residence in Prescott, Arizona, where my folks live. My dad is chief probation officer for Gravelkind County in northern Arizona. And I wanted to live near my son. And I suffer from hay fever, so I had to live up in the mountains. And my wife, with her arthritis, couldn't live back here, although she is now. We decided to live there. A friend of mine from Arizona, northern Arizona, came down. He's a conductor on the Santa Fe Railroad, Alfred C. Bailey. He's the co-author with me on the book. And he said, I'd like to see what you've been accumulating on your trip. And I didn't mention fossils, but I let him read some of the legends, and when he got through some of them, he said, well, this sounds like flying saucers. I thought you were up there gathering legends of the Indians. And I said, well, it does, doesn't it? He said, I wonder what these things are. I said, well, it might be weather conditions of some kind, because after all, we wouldn't be the first ones to observe these weather conditions. The Indians would have seen the same thing, and of course, perhaps make legends about them. He said, well, I was just reading an article that has a lot of ifs in it. But it says, if and when we go to another planet, and if it is inhabited, and if they have radio, some similar type of communication, we will monitor that. And we'll attempt to learn the language and find out the culture of these people, how they think, what they're doing down there before we land. He said, let's put that in reverse for just a moment. And believe me, we were just having a nice visit. We weren't even serious. We were just talking. You know how it is. Commonly known as an old bull session. And that's exactly what it was. He said, well, let's just think for a moment that these things are interplanetary. And there is an intelligence in them. If they're down here, perhaps they would be interested in contacting certain people. for us people that aren't afraid. He's interested in meeting them. He said, but how is the contact of flying saucers? Did you go out on a hilltop and wave a handkerchief when one goes by? I said, well, no, you couldn't do that. Be a long way for us. I said, I heard of a man back east who has been seeing saucers pass over his home in Virginia, and he decided he would use a series of colored lights to try to make some kind of a coast search into the saucers. But I said, I don't have the time or the money to fool around with the lights. Then the subject came up, what about radio? He said, well, you said that they would not, we decided we would monitor their radio broadcasts and so on. Maybe that's what they're doing. He said, why not contact by radio? He said, because I suppose they wouldn't understand it, like maybe now, maybe they wouldn't have our type of equipment and so on. Now I said, well, wait a minute. We know this in anthropology. We'll say all of you here tonight represent a certain tribe, a certain group. And I'm coming in as an anthropologist to study you. Now, my first job would be to find someone in here who's bilingual, that is, someone who speaks my language as well as yours, who speaks both languages. Then they can tell me in English what certain words in your native tongue mean, so I can learn the language more rapidly. But let's say that I only speak my own language, and there isn't anyone out here who can speak my language. If I will sit and listen to all of you talk in your various homes for about 6 months, now it depends on the average is 6 months. Some people are much longer, others less. I have a friend who went into an Indian group and picked up the language in about 3 weeks. Believe me, it takes me much longer. So the average is 6 months. You will begin to understand, I will begin to understand what you people are saying, without ever being told what the words mean. Because that's how a baby learns, and as we get older, it's more difficult to learn a language. But we still can do it. So I told him, if these people had been here since 1947, when Kenneth Arnold first observed them, certainly they know our language, and certainly our Morse code system, because the Morse code is not a secret, used daily, constantly, throughout the world. He said, well, that sounds a little incredible to me. I don't know how that could be done. And we just more or less dismissed it. I finally heard from him about 10 days later. He called me up at work and he said, listen, remember what you said about the flying saucers? And I said, yes. He said, well, we had success. And I said, oh, did you see one? He said, no, I don't mean that. He said, I mean radio. And I said, oh, you're kidding. He said, no, I'm afraid I'm not kidding. Because when I asked the question that all of you were there, I said, is it a hoax? And he said, yes, we think it is. The radio man thinks it's a hoax. He said, believe me, you can't go for it at all. Because he says, what in heaven's name would they contact a nobody like me for? Why don't they contact the government or Einstein or something? I later told the radio man, I said, how do you know they haven't contacted the government and some of these scientists? He said, well, I can go for that. Maybe so. Maybe I'm not the question. At least I'll try to work this thing out. So then he noticed, first of all, he thought it was another amateur that was sending the signal. Then he noticed that the code was extremely loud. He had to turn it in his whole set almost completely off in the volume way down. It was very loud. He noticed that the code was very fast. It was very fast. And he was not only a ham operator, but he was a commercially licensed operator with the Santa Fe Railroad in Arizona, and has a reputation as being very fast on both receiving and sending. And he missed much of it. There's a lot of it he couldn't get. He constantly asked him to slow down. And they would come in and say, we hope this speed is choppy. And when he would ask them to slow down, they would slow down between words, but not between letters. The words would come very fast, and then a long pause, and then another word. So he told us, he said, I know it's not another amateur. Whatever it is, it's a group operation. I said, well, what do you think it could be if it isn't saucers that are interplanetary? And he said, well, if it's on Earth, it might be communist in Mexico. And this idea is a little corny. He didn't keep the idea too long, but thought there might be comments in Mexico sending these signals saying that the saucers were in a planetary assembly, and when we land, why don't do anything about it? Leaders in friendship. And of course, they replied that, and then the Russian pop up. We thought it might be a part of the plan. Preliminary to an atomic bomb attack to cause panic or something. But he dismissed that idea too very quickly. Because then he began to notice that, by the way, his hand shack and the backyard were separated into two sections. One section he used as his workshop, because not only doing work for the Santa Fe, but he's a ham operator, he also does work for the police radios up there, and he's also an engineer for one of the radio stations. So believe me, he's very busy. And he has his transmitter and so on in the other end. He would notice if he was at the workbench, and it took some time for him to catch on to this, but if he was at the workbench, they would always come in and give a preliminary warning before the message started. There's a couple of short beats. And then when he got to the set, the message would start. By the way, he received an international warning. One time there was radio telephone, but the rest of the time it was all radio telegraphy. But if he was at the set, they never gave that preliminary warning. He said, it gives me a very, very fear, and it seems they know whether I'm at the equipment or not. That was the next thing that he noticed. He decided to run some kind of a test to get them to prove who they were, because he thought maybe they could bring a saucer in close or something. He said, listen, I'm operating at a disadvantage. You know who I am? He said, I don't know who you are. And if you made this contact, you must be interested in doing such a thing. So therefore, would you mind, you don't care what you do, whatever you want to do, but would you mind giving us some type of assurance so that we know that you are who you say you are? They immediately came in and said, yes, yes. If you will get a glass, we will be by Solis at high time tomorrow. Well, we put that to mean if we will get a telescope, they will be by the sun at noon the next day. We didn't have a telescope. We didn't know what the heaven frame they meant by being by the sun. I went out the next day, by the way, at noon and looked up at the blazing sun with a naked eye, and of course I didn't see anything. That evening, the newscast coming up from Phoenix, Arizona at 5:45 announced that a large fleet of the so-called flying saucers had been sighted over the Yuma Air Force Base around noon that day. My wife said, uh-oh, that sounds like that might be it. And I said, wait a minute, let's not jump to conclusions. We can take something and try to prove anything. But let's wait till there's something else. The next day, the Los Angeles Times reported that Mount Wilson Observatory, where the middle part of the previous day had observed tremendously large sunspots suddenly appear on the sun. Now, there's nothing unusual about sunspots or the sun, except that this is a period of declining sunspot activity. There shouldn't be any sunspots, at least not that large. And instead of lasting a 2-week to 30-day period, these sunspots only lasted 1 day. Now, to this day, we do not know if there's any connection or not, or if it's just a strange coincidence. I know it's rather appalling to think that these people would be doing something to the sun. I don't know. It may or may not tie in. I'd like to mention here, too, that I have not been a technical man. That's one of the reasons anthropology appeared to me, because I didn't have to take math. And that's what they always say. The men go into anthropology because they don't have to take math, and the women go in it because there's many. But my work in Arizona, by the way, I was NBC promotion manager for radio in Arizona. But I was not a technical man. So what I tell you, as we get into more scientific terminology this evening, is for you to accept or reject. Whether you want to believe it or not, take it or leave it. But I'm not going to interject any of my own opinions or ideas. I'm going to keep away from that as much as I can, because after all, I don't think you're much interested in hearing my opinion. That would just be one man's opinion. And I want you, after you leave here tonight, to have as many opinions as there are people here. But I do feel that the experience you guys had and the experience of others, I think that we should be heard, and I think that you people should hear. I might briefly hear before I get more into our radio content too. I'd like to mention that those of you, by the way, how many have read Flying Saucers Have Landed by Leslie and Adamski? I'd like to mention that my wife and I were the ones, as I said before, that signed that affidavit on the back of Mr. Adamski's book. I'd like to say that everything that he says in there is accurate. But that did happen as he told it. Now, one thing I'd like to clear up, there assist him as perhaps some of the doubts in your mind too. And it's none of Mr. Adamski's fault, and that is this. In the book, and I mention it because many people have asked me about it. First of all, I'll tell you what I got in a letter. A woman wrote to me and she said, listen, we have gone out and tested two binoculars to see if you could see the details that at a mile away that's mentioned in that book, and you can. And she said, the book, Mr. Adamski tells us in the book, that Mrs. Wells, looking through binoculars, is one of the witnesses, looking through binoculars, drew this man. And we know that she couldn't see that detail at that distance. Well, now that's quite true, but I wrote back to this lady and to many others who asked the same question, and he said this. If you will read that again, you will find that it is not in Mr. Adamski's book. It's in the caption under the drawing of the binoculars. Now, as many of you know here, captions are made up by the publisher. Mr. Adamski sent in that drawing that Mr. Wells had made of the Venetian, and he had sent in his manuscript. The publisher figured that since Mrs. Wells was there and observed this thing through binoculars, he must have made the drawing while looking through binoculars. And the publisher put that caption under that picture. It's unfortunate that it got in that way. So if you reread, if any of you have that question in your mind, if you reread your own account and read out the caption, you'll find that that's not in there. She made the drawing from what she did see, and then the details by what the student she supplied later. She couldn't possibly see that detail, if that's it, as anyone knows. But the account is true, as Mr. Adamski wrote. So here we found ourselves in contact with something, and we were very interested. The man finally asked me, he said, listen, do you think we go on with this or what? So we really give it to work. He said, I can give it to work and find out if it's true or not. He said, I'm almost afraid to, because he said, if it is true, it's going to be pretty hard for me to accept, but I'm going to ask you. And I told him, yes, go ahead. By all means, you give it to work, because I said, I'm having a little trouble on the job. By the way, at that time, I wasn't in radio. I was working for the civil service in the Veterans Administration. And perhaps some of you here are in that administration or working in civil service. And you know that you accumulate leave time or sick leave. In order to do this work, I was leaving Texas, going up to farther up in northern Arizona, and I was sick at the same time my wife was. She was working there too. And it began to look close to suspicious. I told him, I said, I'm getting a funny feeling that something's going to happen at work. I said, I've had one or two warnings already, so I said, let's wrap this thing up fast, one way or the other. I said, if it is true, why is she on the job? Then he pulled a test. He knew he was going to, but he didn't tell us what it was going to be. And one evening, seven or eight people were present in the handshack. And he didn't even tell his wife until a week later when he called us in and told us what had happened. He was on 40 meters, and he asked a question and got an answer. And then very quickly, he switched to 150 meters, asked a question, and the answer came right in. Now he told us a week later that even if he had told the other fellow on the other end that he was going to switch from 40 to 160, that the fellow wouldn't have had time to find him, and therefore couldn't have heard the question. And of course, if he didn't hear the question, he couldn't have answered it. That is one of the first steps that he went. The next thing, he had a country visiting him from Baltimore, and he was in contact with some other town. He didn't even mention sausage to the cousin, but he heard a funny buzzing sound. And he went outside where he had the selective tool. Many of you probably hear the mighty right hand or low hand are familiar with it. The selective tool on the outside on his antenna, and when he was sending his phone, his phone flashing on and off. He told his cousin to go outside and see if there was anything wrong out there. And when he did, he heard his cousin say, "Good God, man, get out here." Well, above the antenna had been this large orange disc. And when they stepped, when he stepped out, and when they began to observe it, it switched off and took off. So to see what his cousin would say, he said, "Well, what do you think that was?" His cousin said, "Well, you might think I'm crazy, but I think we just saw one of those flying saucers." So then he broke down and told him what he'd been doing. So the next thing, we thought, well, these people are willing to contact us by radio, maybe they would be willing to land in some remote area. So we asked that, and they said, "Yes, yes, we would be willing to land up. We don't sell for us, we get another saucer sighting." And of course, it's there are hundreds. So we let the radio man make all the arrangements of where we would go and who we would follow in our car. So unexpectedly, the radio man's father-in-law came in from Tennessee that night. Quite an elderly gentleman, by the way, he passed away since. And he was suffering from some kind of brain cancer or tumor. Anyway, he was very senile, very childish, couldn't keep his balance, he was always falling down. And we had finished transmitting for the evening. His daughter brought some coffee out, the hands set, and she said, "I've got a problem, I don't know what to do about my father." So her husband said, "Well, what do you mean?" She said, "Well," she said, "if we take him, if he sees anything, he might have a heart attack. Certainly, I can't tell my father we're going out to meet somebody from another world." He said, "If they see him there, maybe they won't land." And so the husband, the radio man, said, "Well, why don't you leave your father at home?" And he said, "I can't do that because if he's left alone, he might fall down and hurt himself." He said, "Well, we'll get some son to stay with him." She said, "No, because the doctor just said we can't get him emotionally upset." And she said, "Well, if the ladies are in there frying chicken and making sandwiches, he thinks we're going to the mountains for a picnic. He's going to think that he's just not wanted if we don't take him along and leave him with his strangers." She said, "Honestly, I don't know what to do." That was back and forth for way over an hour. We were not attempting any experiment in extrasensory perception or telepathy that never entered our minds. But the receiver was on, the transmitter was off, as I said before. We always left the receiver on because he figured that if there was any, even when he was working in there, he figured they might come in sometime and he always wanted to leave it on. So we discussed this problem. 1 minute we'd say, "Well, we'll take him." The next minute we'd say, "Well, we'll leave it." We didn't know what to do. And suddenly the receiver started and said, "Now about the father." Well, believe me, and you've heard his hair standing up on end, I don't guess mine didn't, but it certainly felt like it. When I looked over his shoulder and saw what he was writing, and he turned around very pale to all of us, and he said, "Believe me, if I ever doubted it, I don't know. Because this is impossible. But it's happening before my very eyes." Now these people told us about this man's condition, which was verified later by a doctor from that town. They explained his condition. They mentioned this man being old and was having some trouble with his kidneys. They said that there was a failing solution by the bed that was hampering the contract. Would someone please remove it and clean it up? And the daughter went inside and sure enough there was. He and I are looking very pale also. And they seem to be knowing everything that was going on. Now before I tell you the main part, by the way, in that message that this old gentleman was the longest one we ever had. And I think perhaps the most important not because of what they told the old gentleman, but because of what they did say, what it might mean, or what it does mean to each and every one of us, and of course the whole world. But before I mention that, I would like to say that the next day, a 14-year-old boy from next door was training his uncle, who's a major in the Air Force, and he was sleeping on a glass room porch. It was August and it was quite warm, and this boy was on this porch. But he came over the next day to the radio man, and he said, "What was going on over here last night?" And the radio man started explaining because he's always on the air almost every night, and all the neighbors around there hear the code. He said, "Well, nothing, I was just on the air as usual." The boy said, "No, I don't mean that." And the radio man became very serious. He said, "Well, what do you mean? Did you see? What did you see? What did you hear?" He said, "Well, I woke up," and he gave the time. And by the way, the time is exactly the same time that we were having this contest about this old gentleman. He was asleep in the house. And he said, "I woke up, I looked at the clock, because I thought I was sleeping, but I pinched myself to find out that I wasn't. I looked out of the porch, and above your house was a long, tubular shaft of white light. I couldn't see where it ended. It kept going on straight up, and I went right down into your bedroom." And, of course, the radio man was pale again. That is just a test, because this boy did not know. No one there knew. In fact, I didn't even tell my dad until several months later what we had been experimenting with and what we'd been doing. And my dad was quite skeptical, by the way, and I told him, I said, "Well, do you doubt me? Don't you believe me when I tell you this?" I said, "I've never lied to you." And he said, "Well, I believe you, but I think perhaps it's the government. You're probably being held. But lately, I heard from my mother, and she said Father finally saw it by himself, being confirmed by his friend, the head of the weather bureau there, that it wasn't a balloon and an airplane. So now he's beginning to wonder, too." The thing that these people said was this, in reference to the old gentleman. They said it would be all right to take him. And then they said, "Never fear the aged, for they can help and they are brought back into life again." Now you can interpret that any way you want to, but I feel that that is very important. Now I know you wonder, well, it's very interesting to speak to a Venusian on the desert, or it's very interesting to talk to Cousins by Sunday radio, but really, when the novelty wears off of it and the excitement flows over, what does it mean? If it just meant that some stray Venusian happened to drop down here and talk to a lone man out in the desert, he took off again, and at the end of it, it doesn't mean anything, really. But what does all this mean? And that's what the people of the world are asking now. If you felt as I would have gone astray, we are coming here, what does it mean to us? Are they here to conquer us? Are we all going to be annihilated? What does it mean and why would they come? And we asked those questions. One of the questions, my wife, as I said before, suffers from arthritis, and she thought, well, maybe these people, we're not going to be so optimistic that we think they're going to give us the secrets of propulsion and so on, because we might need it to destruct the sun. But they might give us the secret of finding out how to cure cancer, polio, and so on. If they have spaceships and they're ahead of us, perhaps they've discovered the cure for these things. So she wanted that question to be asked, but she went into chemistry and anthropology both, mainly chemistry, because she wanted to work in laboratories. That's the work she was doing for the government when we had a contest, by the way, in the bacteriology lab, to find something that would help arthritis. And the question was asked, you have such tremendous development in spaceships, you travel through space and so on, have you advanced in medical science? And they said, no. Yes, no. He said, well, that doesn't make sense. You have spaceships and so on, and you haven't advanced over us in medical science? Why? And they said, simple. No disease, no medical science. Now, believe me, This salty business is fantastic. But even living is salty is fantastic. The fact that we're alive and sitting here is fantastic. I remember what Voltaire said when someone told him, he said, "I just approached a friend who's trying to make him believe in reincarnation, but I just can't believe that he lived more than once. It's fantastic." And Voltaire said, "No, my friend, it's not fantastic that he lived twice at once. See that, he might live many times." So this fact is thing is fantastic. Truth is stranger than fiction. And we have to keep an open mind. And that's what I have tried to do, and the rest of us in this whole thing is to keep an open mind. Because we realize that what we know now is only a very pale shadow of what we're going to know tomorrow. Remember the boys in Columbus's time at the Spanish court, he was held there 3 years because these great scientists thought they knew all there was to know about science. They were absolutely certain that the earth was flat. But of course we know now that that is not true. They really should have known better because Columbus was not the first one to say that. The ancients knew the earth was round. It wasn't anything new. In fact, I might say that the ancients knew that other planets were inhabited. That's nothing new. Really, there's nothing that these people have informed us of that did do. There's nothing new under the sun, I guess. About our atomic experiments. Because there's so much talk about sunny weather and tornadoes and what have you. And they said, yes, they were quite concerned about our atomic experiments. Many people have said to me, how in heaven am I when this present earthquake took place many months ago at about 1,200 people killed. It was about 3 days, by the way, after an atomic bomb was set off. I mentioned to someone that the atomic bombs were shaking up our earth fault and were causing some of these things. And they said, now, wait a minute. I was only 200 or 300 miles away from the bomb blast. And nothing happened to me or any of my neighbors, and you're trying to tell me something died in person because of it? I said, now, just a minute. Astronomers tell us that large sunspots appear on our own sun, which is over 90 million miles away, when an atomic bomb is set off. So I said, if it can affect the sun that far away, certainly it can affect persons. Well, these people are concerned about our atomic bombs, but it is not our atomic bombs that is their main concern. They said this, that our entire solar system is moving into a new area of the universe. And that cosmic ray bombardment will increase at a terrific rate. They said this many months ago. Now recently, Dr. Seitz, very famous American physicist, working in Colorado, in the mountains, and he's now down at Taylor College, Brazil, 18,000 feet in the mountains, getting the same results, announced to the scientific world that the electron count has speeded up and that the cosmic ray bombardment was increasing at a tremendous rate, and the present theory would not account for it in any way. And he was very alarmed. He's still alarmed, I might add, up on top of the mountain. They told us this before this was discovered. Another thing they mentioned was about the extra satellites or moons that we have. Recently, that was announced by Dr. Lepas and also Dr. Clyde Tombaugh, discoverer of the planet Pluto. It's only recently been announced, but I know that they were working on it way over 2 years ago. In fact, they were working a few miles from us at Lowell Observatory when we had our radio contact in northern Arizona, because many of our contacts spoke on the radio, the faculty spoke of Lowell Observatory. And I know they were installing over $1 million worth of electronic equipment on top of Mars Hill to do some kind of work, and I didn't know what it was. But it was to locate these two satellites, or these two artificial space stations that are now in the Earth's gravitational field. It's not a secret. Frank Edwards has had it on his newscast. It's been broadcast in different scientific journals and so on. So it's nothing new. But they never mention what these things are. They are not Russian space stations, and they don't belong to us. They travel so rapidly that we couldn't pick them up by telescope. But they have detected them with electronic equipment. But his people also mentioned that. They said that as we move into this new area of the universe, that there are going to be some very strange things take place on the physical, mental, and spiritual plane. People's minds are going to change, for one thing. Also, the tornadoes, earthquakes, volcanoes that are blowing their tops that have never been active in the history of man, the ones in Alaska, and others in the Pacific and other places now that are becoming active. So some of them are like tropical, and some of those have been active before, but are now broken forth again. You just watch the news papers in the small corners for the news, and you can see the trend yourself. The Ionian Island disaster is terrible. An area in the Mediterranean where two of the Earth's major fault lines converge. Then again, the large explosion that was startled at Seattle here a couple of years ago, the green fireball that exploded and caused such a reverberation throughout the Seattle area in Washington. Seattle is also over an area where two major fault lines of the Earth converge. Now these factors, all of them, are not coming in the same place. Before I say where, let me tell you what these people have to say about man. Man, where from, why so, and where to. They say that man is not man because he has two legs, two arms, and two eyes placed in a certain position in the head, and because he has come up from the anthropoid earth. They say that man is man because he is a spiritual being. That man exists throughout the universe. Man, as a race, is an inhabitant of space. And that he takes that certain physical manifestations or vehicles on certain planets to learn certain lessons and have certain pleasure, pain, experiences. Now we can write it very simply to a class, to a school. One thing these people don't want to do is interfere. Let's say we're in the eighth grade. Would you go down to the first grade and discipline the class and laugh at them because they have very simple problems, or because they're still fooling around with blocks or something? And we know we can't get out of the first grade until we get it. There's no way to do it. Once in a while we might skip a grade if we're especially smart or bring an apple to the teacher or something, but we're not going to get out of there until we make the grade. And they say we are not going to get our first one until we make the grade. And they liken it to the words of Christ, in my Father's house are many mansions. In space there are many planets, and they say all of them are all inhabited by life. Now, immediately the thought arises, what about some of our astronomical theories and so on? Well, let me throw a hard turn into one or two of those. I think we can get a good idea of how accurate we have been. The science of astronomy is known as a true and pure science because it's based in mathematics, for one thing. This is just how true and pure it is. When most of us were in school, you'll recall that they said the planet Jupiter, and I bet these young fellows right here now, tonight, would say the same thing that their textbooks now tell them, that Jupiter contains deadly methane and ammonia gas. Is that right, boys? Okay, well recently they have announced in scientific journals that they were 100% wrong. That Jupiter is hydrogen, it's not methane and ammonia. Now if they're 100% inaccurate about one thing, they're liable to be about something else. Also very recently, as many of you know, it's been in most of the papers, they have discovered that the distances to Andromeda and the other great galactic systems besides our own Milky Way are double the distance. Again, they were 100% wrong, twice as far away as they thought. So it's the same as in Columbus's time. The scientists of Columbus's time are not any less great because they said the Earth is flat. Unquestionably, they were great minds at the time. But on today's mistake, our basic truth is tomorrow. People say again that all planets are inhabited to a certain extent by some type of life. They say that comets are planets in the making. Now that is one of the latest astronomical theories. They are throwing over the old nebular and planetesimal hypothesis that we blew off from the sun and so on, also that the moon blew off from the earth. The latest theory is that planets are formed in other celestial bodies by cosmic matter accumulating in space and getting bigger and bigger like a snowball rolling downhill. These people say that comets are planets in the making. After millions of years, this comet cools off and vegetation and so on appears, and single cell life develops indigenous to that planet. And when the planet is ready for human life, or the classroom is all readied up, spiritual life arrives from outer space. In other words, what these people are saying is that they are your brothers and sisters, that they are not different, they are not a different creation. The only reason you're down here is because you're getting fertilized in this classroom. The reason they're on Mars or Venus is because they have left that place. But there is no difference. They say that life came from outer space in the beginning to the planet Earth. But the story in Genesis of Adam and Eve is true, but is allegorical. Not true, but any one of you is a spaceman too. Also, we're all space people because we don't live underground. We live on the surface of the planet. So we're as much space people as the people on Mars. We are not spacecraft people. We don't travel from planet to planet. But we are space people. Human beings like ourselves. Very recently, Professor Al O'Kinney, one of the world's foremost geographers, announced, and he was very excited when he did so, and believe me, when I spoke in Cincinnati here about 10 days ago, a lady came up to me whose brother-in-law is head of the government department of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington that has now been called on to investigate this particular phenomenon. He's a botanist, and he's in charge of this particular department. He said, I was so glad you mentioned Professor Howard's work, because my brother-in-law is working on that same thing in this country. And that is, they have discovered that all of the Earth's bacteria that forms humus is dying at a rapid rate. In other words, it takes 9,000 years to produce a certain type of humus. If it doesn't replenish itself, it's will leave in 2 years, which means to look at famine for Earth. And there is no stopping it. It is continuing to die because of the increased cosmic rays on bugs. Now, these things are absolute facts, and they can be checked on. All you have to do is believe me as we get in papers. Dr. Seitz's work would not get into the newspapers. It got into a few scientific journals, and it immediately has stuff. But if you look in some of the back pages of the Science Newsletter, which goes out to many school students, you'll find that this site works. In fact, these stocky intelligence is told us by radio. It doesn't matter whether you believe who you are in contact with or not, because if this thing is clear, it's going to happen. I've always believed what Francis Bacon said, that truth is the daughter of time and not of authority. If what I say is true, why, it will live on. If it isn't, it will die a very quick death. And no one's going to be harmed very much. But on the slight sense that it is true, it is very, very important. Because every one of us here tonight, and in part I could go to the same, as I know mine has already been tested as true. And I had to throw a lot of my old stuffy ideas out the window. Over the years I went to school to learn in anthropology about where man is supposed to come from and so on, why I had to throw a lot of that out. But I guess it's pretty good. John Robinson in England, the young astronomer, has set many of the older astronomers on their heads recently by announcing that 70 miles above our Earth, there is a layer of pure hydrogen. In other words, if you were on Mars and you were looking through a spectroscope at Earth, you'd say nothing in heaven's name can live on Earth because of hydrogen. Now, we know that all life, oxygen, water vapor, and so on, is found near the surface of our planet. And remember what I just said about Jupiter? They have just announced that it is hydrogen, not less than an amount. So, why can't someone live on Jupiter? Another thing, some of our astronomers seem to be such great authorities on what these other bodies are, our so-called astrophysicists, who say that these bodies are such and such, or such and such. Recently, a very well-known astronomer announced that the core of Jupiter is definitely something. How can he know that when our own geologists are still debating the question of whether our core is solid or not? We don't even know the nature of our own planet under our feet. How are we going to know what Jupiter has millions upon millions of miles away? Also, between the spectroscope and Jupiter, you have millions of miles where all kinds of cosmic debris can be floating around. That's why the spectroscope sometimes will get one reading for Venus and another time will get a totally different reading from the same spectroscope. They say that, as I said before, that all planets are inhabited. In our system, they say there are 12 planets, not 9. And of course, 12 is very important in our symbology and in our historical legends, such as 12 apostles, 12 months, 12 times the zodiac, and so on. You go on and on. Also, the 12 times 12, or 144. Those are all found in symbology. They say that there is one planet beyond Pluto and two more between Mercury and the Sun. And one of those has already been seen in transit in the late 1800s and thrown in transit across the Sun's surface, and it was named Vulcan, but was not accepted by most of the scientific world. The contrast that we have were mostly with Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. They say that Saturn is the tribunal of our solar system, or headquarters, as it were. Now, there's been many debates. I know a lot of you have read a good many of the Saucer books. Perhaps some of you have read all those Saucer books throughout this term. And you see these various Saucer researchers arguing. Now, the Saucer, are the Saucerian, the Saucer, are there some other worlds of other dimensions? Are they invisible? Are they secret? Are they just planet spirits of our dead coming back? In other words, by dying, do we really pass into another dimension, another world? And I see that's what the crosses are. Crosses coming back from the grave. Are they actual beings like ourselves in a three-dimensional world on another planet, such as Mars itself, or even another system? Now, all of those things are accurate to a certain degree. The crosses are coming from many different places, from our own solar system, from other solar systems, which are in our own dimension, and they're also coming from higher dimensions. They claim that at the present time, there are 51 solar systems in the Confederation that is working around Earth, including 608 planets, and that they have 3.5 million spacecraft surrounding the planet at this time. They say that they have agents throughout the Earth, that there are 10 million people not of Earth on the surface of our planet at this time. 6 million in the United States. Now, I can break that down. All of those people are not people that have just stepped off of the ship. And later I will try to explain that, and we'll probably get some questions on it. Because I don't want to go into that now. It's just another lecture hall in itself. But there is a tremendous interest in our planet from outer space. Now, these people claim we are not God, we're only a little bit ahead of you, we make plenty of mistakes. But we figure that all of this is going to happen on your planet if you discover nuclear energy and so on about 1960, between 60 and 70. But because of the Second World War and the speed-up in technical advance, it came about in the 40s. And so we knew our whole system was passing into a new area of the universe, and there's certain things had to be done. Because certain conditions will not exist on Earth in the new vibratory rate. Also, as I said before, these people are not going to interfere in the sense of coming down and stopping all this. You know, many people say, well, if there is a God, why did he stop the war? It's so terrible. And they also say that about the Saucer people. If they're so powerful and they love mankind and they hate to see us killing each other, good night, I'm Mrs. Jones and I don't want to kill Mrs. Blavatsky or something over in Russia. What if they come down and save the poor people here in, on the world? that don't want to fight the common people. But they're not going to do that. They're not going to do that for this reason, as I said before, they are not going to stop what we are learning in this classroom. Because there are certain souls or certain developments that need to go through wars on this planet, and after they go through wars and they get blown up about 20,000 times, finally the soul realizes that it's all and it is finished. And then it goes on to man. Now these people do not like to see war, they don't like to see the cream of our youth destroyed in war, and all of our good is saved. But at the same time, they do not look upon war as we do in this sense. Because they claim that life is eternal, and therefore if you lose one physical vehicle, it doesn't matter very much because you live forever anyway. They see these boys down in the battlefield, they realize it is not death. And that those particular boys are learning something. However, they say that we are the only warring planet in this section of the universe. And we are not the only planet that has war. But in this section of the universe, we are. And to give an example of that, they mentioned that there are no other systems where the people have just invented the wheel and have an axle, and they found out that if they put these rods on the axle, it wouldn't wear obstacles. So there are places where men are still running around with clubs, and there are planets that are just cooling off. It's a continual process. I might add that the whole thing is a circular affair. There is no goal. There is no goal. We are all heading towards perfection, but we'll never get there. We are not the lowest planet in the whole business, but in this section we are. In other words, we thought we were so grand and we're nothing but the garbage thing. And someone was telling me today that some woman was so hurt because some lecturer said that our planet was a garbage thing. In fact, one woman interviewed me in Cincinnati for the newspapers, and she said, you know, I could go for all of this, but I just can't believe that anything in all of creation could have anything superior to what America has. It's very nice, and believe me, I'm proud that I'm an American citizen, I'm proud of our attainments and developments and so on, but anyway, she didn't like the garbage can idea, but we have to face that that's what this is. Another woman asked me, what do these people say about hell? And I said, well, I know that this is what they would tell you. You're on it right now. You're in it right now. You'll never be any closer to it. One time it was mentioned, the Venetians were asked, your world sounds like heaven. And they said, no, you must not say that because we are very, very true. What did you think of a planet that was 6 trillion years ahead of us? Said that man does not always take the form that we know him now, the form that we had at this time. Now this is, believe me, very getting very, very fantastic, but I have to give it, it's what we were told. They said, we know of worlds, although we cannot comprehend them, but we know that there are worlds where man needs to be and nothing can form. Now imagine a tree going along with a triangle. But I mean, it's just beyond our comprehension. As the good book says, eye has not seen and ear has not heard what the Father has in store. These people say that that is true. This particular planet, when you have the form that we have, man is supposed to be in fixed form to learn the lessons that this particular world has to offer. Now, I can fill you up a little bit this way. Yes, there will be catastrophes. I'm not going to keep that away from you. I don't want to start a panic, but there will be catastrophes. It's already started. Earthquakes will increase. Certain lands will go under. There will be more floods. The polar caps are melting at a very fast rate. We had quite a iceberg in North Florida recently. That's why the avalanches in Europe recently, the buried villages, you recall, it's been in the newsroom storm. The snow is melting. That's why the ice flows in the northern European harbors not too many months ago. It clogged the harbors, the ships couldn't get in or out. Now these flat lines which cover the earth I forgot to bring my map. I wish I had, but these fault lines are maybe ones that cover the Earth. When we decided on where to perform our atomic experiments, of course, the government took the place where they would have to move the least amount of people. And of course, the Southwest was decided upon in New Mexico. But unfortunately, the experiments were set off right over two of our major fault lines. Also in the Pacific. Remember when the big one was set off, I think on March 25th, wasn't it? That about a day later, the terrific quakes in Hawaiian Island. The atomic bombs then are not causing the same conditions, but they are accentuating an already dangerous situation. And our lines of weakness are under more strain and stress because of the atomic bomb. That's why you go along and you see a little crack in the ground and you stomp around it a little bit while you look at it and the whole thing may give away. So there will be catastrophe. But these people say the world is not coming to an end. That only the good and the beautiful, only the two golden age that we once knew on Earth, which all historians talk about, when man had the ability to speak with angels. Maybe that's just what's returning. Man now has the ability to speak to these people from outer space. Yet that age is going to be turned. That disease will no longer exist. They will show us and can prove to our satisfaction that life will be eternal. That we do not have to struggle by the sweat of our brow, hoping and praying and being taken up to the brink of the grave, and hoping and praying and saying, I have faith, I hope it's all true. No longer will we have to go on that offense. Now we asked him, he said, well, what about a creator? Do you believe? He said, yes, indeed, we do. We believe in the same God as you call him. We believe in the same God as you, so do we. And he said, well, we have many gods, we have many churches, but a mass Methodist God is the same as a Catholic God. We all believe in the same God. And they said, yes, but you worship by word, not by deed. Well, that's true. Young men throughout the world, not only America, and when these people speak, by the way, I might add, they never speak in a derogatory fashion against any nation, against any race, against any church. When they speak of it all as a totality or a people of Earth. We also asked about contacts with Russia, and they said, yes, they have contacts with Sincere and Intercity, but they speak in Russia. But that it's not as easy, especially with radio contrast, for the simple reason that the Russian people aren't allowed to have ham sending sex very much. But they have contact with 31. They're interested in everyone in the world. By saying that, I lost my thought. So they have come then to everyone. In fact, they said, one of them found what they used as a basis of contacting people, and they said, we do not choose you, you choose us. So they're interested in anyone who is interested in truth. I might add too that for a long time, science has been on the left and religion on the far right. And more through the years, they're becoming closer and closer together. You know, when science was discovering certain fossil remains and geology was, or paleontology was born, the church was appalled because they thought the final sizes didn't take away everything in the church. They took a very large bone that had been discovered in Europe and hung it up in a church and said it was one of the bones of Adam. That's how the compromise was defined. These two things are coming closer and closer together. And how can science be separated from religion? How can faith contradict truth? Someone asked me in Cincinnati, why would anyone want to combine science and religion for heaven's sake? But I would say that there is no religion higher than truth. And if science has some of that truth and religion has some of that truth, then that truth cannot contradict itself. And I feel that we must show the scientists the religion of science, and the religionists the science of religion. Because those two things are going to be one. Also, under the two cosmic wave bombardment, they say that all falsity, all hoaxes, and all of those things will pass away, that we won't have to wonder if these things are true. he will know. That's one of the many things he was going to come about. You notice now that I know when I was in school, Piltdown Man was thrown down my throat, and finally, I always wondered about Piltdown Man because the jaw is very deep, and the skull is very much like modern man. You notice the research, you can find out how many things are being thrown up for what they are. You can call it the true light coming from Aquarius. You can call it the new vibrations or the new density. You can call it the new dimension. Now, as of the fall of last year, we left the old first density, and we are no longer in it at all. We are in the transitional stage, or in the beginning of a new dimension, or a new density, right now. Of course, the train is coming very slowly, and that's why we don't notice it too much. So they've gone from Pisces to Aquarius. Many of you in here would say that. Others say density or dimension is gone. These people then are coming from many different places that are here merely to go along and usher us into the new dimension. Usher us into this new age. One other thing then, before closing, people have wondered what is going to happen in the future. And people have said they wouldn't interfere. They will eventually interfere. I mean, I'm contradicting myself now, but I'll explain that. They say that they are going to wait to see whether we decide upon peace or war. If we decide on a peaceful one world, why they will land on a ship in a new age on earth. And if we decide on a aggressive war, they will let the atomic war go long enough because there are different souls that must have the lessons, and then they will interfere after that. In other words, when civilization is destroyed and people are saying, now what, and look to the skies and to down on their knees, then they will land on a ship to the new age. So regardless of what we do, there is a new age coming. First of all, we think what I was saying before, the people who are not interfering, they are not trying to accomplish any of these methods, by the way, by force. Nothing by force. At one time they said, yes, we are here to conquer Earth. That's true, they have agents all over the place. But not conquer as we think of conquering anything. We are here to conquer the Earth with the law. And we are anxious. For men like yourself, and we have investigated, we know that through our life, and telling the truth, we want the people of the world to find out about these things through men like yourself. We are not going to announce any headlines yet. We are going to go and slowly get the American people used to the idea that other planets are inhabited. Maybe the Mars Committee that's going to look at Mars here in a few days. It has been stated by several newscasters that they know. Use that time to announce that other planets are inhabited. So that makes me shocked. Once we're over the shock of that, and our sides hurt a little bit, because we finally were masters of the universe, then we will slip into the darkness. We cannot blame the government. So many people say, oh, the government, they're just awful, they don't tell us about this. We cannot blame the government, because after all, who is the government? That's a very vague term. A lot of us have friends in the government. After all, what would you do if you had that type of information to spread to a nation? I feel that they're doing the best thing they can, and I feel that they're taking very good-naturedly a lot of rotten eggs and vegetables. Because they have, if you notice, an article will come out, says they speak about the sausage and so on, and it's nothing but a rehash of the old material, like in one of the articles not too many weeks ago in two magazines. What the Air Force found out about the sausage, and it certainly wasn't anything new. I happen to know the man that wrote the article. It was not Captain Hooper, whose name is on the article, as a ghostwriter that wrote a story. You notice they always say so many, so much percent, and so on, unidentified, not known. Now, what they're doing by suddenly swinging one way one moment and then the full 1 minute time the next is to get people to talk. They have made the sausage controversial to get people to talk about it, to spread the information. So I feel that our government is doing the best thing it can under the circumstances. I'd like to also announce this time that because I don't feel I'm violating national security to do so. There was a target known as NC-707 at Edwards Air Force Base, which is nothing but a project in telecommunications with sponsors. They contact the craft and attempt to get them to land with a target to lose all of them. The greatest astronomical observatories of the world have 16 because it makes broadly down to the size powers play. Certainly a lot more than we do by far. Now whether they'll ever give out this information or not, or whether they'll slowly let it creep in, and then we all know it anyway, why they'll let it out. Conclusion, when is it all going to take place? Our radio message has said many times, very soon. So we said for maybe 10,000 years, for years soon. What do you mean by soon? And they said, when we say soon, we mean soon as you think it's soon. And if you personally knew that, that must be pretty quick. Also, they say, and they throw this in, so we ask about, well, if you don't die, I mean, if you don't have the disease, then you don't die. And they say, well, yes, you do. But dying is not dying because you're in eternity right now. So there is no death. But they mentioned, by the way, on Mars and Venus and so on, that they live between 200 and 1500 years. And as we know, you. And when the lesson has been learned, and they have learned that costume, they're ready to go to the next, they really go in and pass out of the picture. They say that it is not natural for man to die in agony, cancer, and other diseases. They also say that it's not the little germs that we're facing around all the time that kill us or cause disease. The germs are really the scavengers, and it's incorrect thinking that causes disease. I can hear the Christian Scientist say hello. But God bless him, that's true. So I know that perhaps you have a lot of questions, and I think we should get to the question and answer period. Maybe you'd like to stand up and speak with us. Thank you very much.